organization created in three versions, a Northwest, a Southern, and Colored, were established to cope with farmers' issues such as currency deflation, the monopoly practices of railroads and banks, as well as concerns over political corruption. These organizations existed in the late 1880s. Question two. It was a tariff decrease established in 1894 during the second Cleveland administration, and if you read in your textbook, which I did today, I didn't realize this before, that he let it come into law without his signature because he was so disgusted with the earmarks that were attached to it. But anyway, a tariff decrease in 1894 during the second Cleveland administration. It included a 2% income tax on incomes of over $4,000. But the income tax portion of this tariff was challenged as unconstitutional and overthrown in the Supreme Court through the Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust case. So all we're looking for is what is the 1894 tariff that I'm singing about. Get past all that. That's two. So item one is an organization that farmers engaged in to improve their conditions, and item two is an 1894 tariff. Item three, what Republican presidential candidate lost the 1884 election to Cleveland, probably mostly due to his refusal to recant the comments, "Rum, Romanism, and Rebellion," at a fundraising dinner in New York? Some also say that his association with the Mulligan Papers may have cost him many votes also. If this is of any help as trivia, he did serve as Secretary of State for three different Republican presidents. Question four. What was the group of unemployed farmers who left Ohio in 1894 and marched or traveled to Washington, D.C., in order to persuade Cleveland to inflate the money supply and create artificial jobs for the unemployed during the 1893 panic? They were arrested for trespassing on the White House lawn. Another thing I got excited about reading in the textbook here. Their sons, the leader of this movement, for whom its name, Sons, was named Legal Tender. So, that'd be a cool name for a kid. So what's the group named for the leader that came from Ohio? We'll repeat these. And if you start now, you can have 100%. Question five. Name the 1883 Act of Congress which created the civil service examination system to prevent the excesses of the spoil system or patronage, most likely passed because of the publicity associated with the killing of James A. Garfield. Signed into law by Chester Allen Arthur. Number six is a four-word phrase. What was the tactic used by the Republican Party in the Gilded Age period to remind voters that Democrats, and especially Southern Democrats, had started the Civil War, and it was the Republican Party in the North which had won the war and saved the nation? A tactic which actually didn't stop in the Gilded Age, even though that's what it's called at that time. Question seven. This was a movement that arose among churches, both Protestant and Catholic, in the Gilded Age in the United States. Its representative leaders included Washington Gladden, Norman Thomas, and Walter Rauschenbusch. It was a movement that said churches have more responsibility than just saving souls for the next life. They should concern themselves with the detrimental social conditions in cities in this life. Okay, question 8. She, along with Ellen Gates Starr, established the famed settlement house, the Hull House, in 1889, not 1886, as I so falsely lectured when I was listening to one of my tapes, but 1889. She wrote about her experiences working with the poor and the immigrants in a book called 20 Years at Hull House, and her efforts at opposing war earned her the Nobel Peace Prize in 1931. Name her. And now for a short little commercial announcement. Speaking of famous women who are activists, looking at your edition of the textbook has a lot of changes from when I first put the lecture together. And there's a little ditty about Mother Jones, who's a really famous labor leader from Ireland. I don't know if you read this. This is not on your test anywhere else. Just cool stuff. And she came to the United States, and family was all wiped out by disease in Memphis, moved to Chicago, had her personal business wiped out by the Chicago fire in 1871. And from that point on, became a labor activist for the Knights of Labor and later the United Mine Workers. And she was dubbed by many the most dangerous woman in America because she was such an excellent activist and protest marcher. The magazine Mother Jones, a liberal kind of investigative journalist magazine, is named for her in the spirit of her. And that's in your textbook if you're interested in it. And now back to this quiz. Item 9. Name the cartoonist who created both the donkey for the Democrats and the elephant for the Republicans, and is also remembered through his cartoon work for exposing the fraud and corruption of boss William Marcy Tweed in New York City. In fact, if you stick a Y on the end of his name, that is where that word came from. That didn't help much. I already knew the answer. Question 10, give one of two different choices. Give either the disembarkation point for Eastern European immigrants in New York City begun in 1892 that's been turned into a famous landmark, or give the same thing, the disembarkation station in San Francisco Bay for Chinese and Japanese immigrants, which has also been turned into a historical location, national historical site. So either the one in 1892 in New York Harbor is famous for immigrants coming through, or the one for Far East immigrants coming in to San Francisco. Give either place. Question 11. They were destroyed by the bad publicity associated with the Haymarket Square incident because of the seeming association with anarchism and violence. What was this labor organization that accepted skilled, unskilled, all races, all sexes, and only excluded, if I remember correctly, bankers, liquor salesperson, doctors, and lawyers? Question 12. Still in existence today, what labor union, founded in 1886 by Samuel Gompers, recruited only skilled workers and depended upon direct action tactics such as boycotts and strikes to achieve their aims? What labor organization, created in 1886? Some of you may be members. Question 14. What U.S. president claimed during the Pullman strike, if it took every soldier in America to deliver a postcard in Chicago, that postcard would be delivered? Yes. Name the U.S. president who, during the Pullman strike, declared, if it takes every soldier in America to deliver a postcard in Chicago, that postcard will be delivered. Yeah. 1894. That's 13. 14 is coming up here now. Fourteen does relate back to 3, so my chore is to avoid giving away the answer to 3 in the question here. 14 is, what faction of the Republican Party became so disgusted with their candidate in 1884 over the accusations of corruption associated with the Mulligan Papers that they switched over and voted for Cleveland instead? Their name was derived potentially from a Native American word or from sitting on a fence and being unable to decide. Well, I can see in your eyes this is not the most popular quiz I've given. But it's like an inoculation, because when you hear the answers, you'll do fine on the test later. Repeats? 5 is the 1883 Act signed into law by Chester Allen Arthur, which created the civil service system. Most likely came into because of the publicity associated with Garfield's assassination. Yes. 2 is the 1894 tariff decrease, which had an income tax declared unconstitutional attached to it. 7 is what social movement, which involved religious organizations and included such people as Walter Rauschenbusch, Washington Gladden, and Norman Thomas, declared that it wasn't enough for churches just to save souls in the afterlife, that they should be concerned with taking care of the poor and the distressed in city life in the Gilded Age. 13 is, who was the president in 1894 that said that he would put it down in paraphrase, if it took every soldier in America to deliver a postcard in Chicago, the card's going to get delivered. It's obviously in reference to Debs and the Pullman strikes putting mail on these cars during the strike. They didn't, but the railway managers put the cards or the mail on. 4 is, name the group of unemployed farmers from Ohio and other parts of the Midwest that marched or traveled at least to Washington in an effort to try to persuade Cleveland to urge Congress to inflate the money supply and use the printed dollars to create artificial jobs for the unemployed during the Panic of 1893. Their pleas were ignored, and instead they were arrested for trespassing on the White House lawn. 9 is the cartoonist, one of the most famous cartoonists, who exposed the corruption through cartoons of Boss William Marcy Tweed. That's still a good sign if there's not that many repeats. So. If no others, we'll pass them up and finish the material. And a good thing is the name. When your name's on there, those points can go in that book. Every once in a while, maybe. Whatever you really got. Yes. I'll have somebody else, not me, pronounce it aloud. If it sounds like mugwump, it's correct. Okay, we have them all? Okay, here are the answers. In between the Granger movement and the Populist Party were farmer alliances. The 1894 tariff decrease was the Wilson-Gorman tariff. There's extra questions. Sorry. And the candidate, Republican candidate who lost the 84 election is James G. Blaine. And in a future question, those Republicans in number 14 which refused to vote for him were called mugwumps. Voted for Cleveland instead. The unemployed farmers who marched to Washington, Coxey's Army, said that Jacob Coxey's son was named Legal Tender Coxey. Number 5, the Pendleton Act created civil service reform. Number six, the tactic of reminding voters that Democrats, especially Southern Democrats, started the war was waving the bloody shirt. The reform movement of churches to address social issues was social gospel. Founder of the Hull House was Jane Addams. Thomas Nast and his nasty cartoons, so to speak, exposed William Marcy Tweed. Now, here's one of my tactics here. I don't think Nast is himself. Maybe he is, but I don't think Nast is on our test. But Tweed is, and he's associated with the Tammany Hall corruption. So that got him slipped into the question, so you'll hear it and remember that. So. And the immigration stations were either Ellis Island in New York City or in San Francisco Bay is Angel Island. Either one works. The Knights of Labor was destroyed by the Haymarket Square incident. The American Federation of Labor, the AFL, was created in a sense to replace the Knights of Labor by Samuel Gompers.
And what happened when you
If you put American Federation of Labor, you're all right. AFL's good too. Yeah. So we'll see how close it gets. Cleveland was the one who declared he would use all the troops in America to deliver postcards during the Pullman strike in Chicago. And that's all 14. Okay, final material. We're on item 42, but we're going to draw 41 part 1 and make it to the end. We went over 2 through 9, the other planks of the party platform, in which we saw especially, well, what theme would you say is there themes that are repetitive in these planks, what are they, or what is it? Democracy, democratization, power to the people, as the Populist Party name implies. Whether it's through political reforms or whether it's to harness the power, the commercial power of the business owners. And some of this is very quasi-socialist, not in a farmer sense, but in an urban sense. So I think populists would have really wanted 2 through 9 to be more important than 1. Although 1's a critically important issue for them, it's not something they wanted to become singular. And yet, in the 1896 election, a few years away, it does become singular due to the Democratic candidate, which we'll talk about. So let's talk about that plank, what it means. The free and unlimited coinage of silver at a ratio of 16 to 1. In the very beginning of the nation, when Hamilton was Secretary of the Treasury, he's the one that campaigned for and pushed making the gold-silver ratio 15 to 1. And it stayed 15 to 1 until about Civil War period. What that would mean is for every 15, or in this case 16, ounces of gold of silver that you traded to the government, you could get back an ounce of gold. So that would be the exchange rate of the two. And the coining of both gold and silver coins was quite steady from the beginning of the country up until about 1873. Then after 1873, silver was demonetized. It was no longer a coin. And there's lots of debates and arguments why that came about. We'll address that in a minute. So by the time this platform is put together, 1892, there is no silver. Well, that's not true either. There is not enough silver being coined to satisfy inflationists. And so that's why they wanted, in the phrase free and unlimited, they meant as much silver that can be mined and sold to the government should be turned into coins. Now, what would be their concerns, the silverites, so to speak, for wanting all this silver to be coined? Assume beyond. You're not a silver miner, and it's not going to be a direct profit from you to sell the silver to the government. Obviously, those people want that. But you're somebody else. Why would you want to see more silver coined, even if you had no interest in that? More money in circulation. Yeah. To create more inflation. As from the diagram we drew before, if there are more consumers or if there's more money in the aggregate chasing goods and services, there's going to be inflation, and prices and wages will go up. And the people who are most benefited directly by this are debtors. People who have a fixed debt to pay, like farmers. So that if money itself becomes worth less and more money has to go into circulation, but their debts stay the same to the banks, they can more easily pay just from a currency inflation, regardless of what other factor changes. So most of the people who favored, whether it's coining silver or issuing more greenbacks, as I'll talk to you about in a minute here, are really seeking inflating the currency supply for their situation, which would put the creditors, the bankers, on the opposite end of that. They're going to be the ones that want to make sure that a more sound, safe money supply exists rather than one that loses its value. Kind of a third issue that comes into this is, if a money supply itself cannot grow, can an economy? And we've kind of come to, as a world, and especially as a nation in the 20th century, come to agree, to a certain degree, with the populace, that the idea that you actually do need an inflating currency supply that's not tied to a fixed amount. I guess the last vestiges of that came in 1971 when Nixon completely declared through executive order that we would not have our dollars tied to the gold standard any longer, so that it'd be tied to the currencies of the rest of the world so we can grow in numbers. So in that regards, even though the populists and these inflationists were somewhat painted up as harebrained at the time, in the bigger long-range picture, a growing currency was the more valuable way for economic growth. But in the immediate sense, it would benefit debtors rather than bankers. So with all that convoluted explanation, we're ready to go into 43, and we've said that already. It was a desire to inflate the currency and to alleviate indebtedness to banks. Historically, let's see how this movement has its roots. In 44, I have this memory of having mentioned greenbacks to you. I don't know why, but I just think I did for some reason. Issued during the Civil War to help pay for the war, still in circulation after the war. It was the only money in the 19th century printed by the government, not backed by hard currency, gold or specie or gold and silver. And it's not surprising, therefore, that creditors or bankers would be very uncomfortable with that money and would advocate for its eventual removal, which occurred in 1875 through the Resumption Act. So from 1875 on, as more and more money is leaving circulation, but the population and business is growing, or trying to grow in this shrinking money supply, the debtors suffer even greater and feel like one of the solutions is to go back to printing greenback dollars. So there's a movement between 1876 and 1884, a third-party movement called the Greenback Party, sometimes seen in some textbooks as the Greenback Labor Party. And it shouldn't be surprising that in 1880, their candidate is James B. Weaver, our populist from number 39, who was the 1892 presidential candidate. So Weaver has been associated with inflationist movements in two different directions, the greenback movement and then later the populist silver movement. They obviously don't achieve their wishes, and by the 1890s, they've moved away from the paper money argument, trying to come around to say, well, if you're fearful of paper that's backed by nothing, then let's go with a hard currency, silver, because historically silver and gold had a value relationship with each other. Silver had been, silver had been stopped in its coinage in 1873, which is what 46 is going to be about here. Now, the reason for it is not the reason the populace will assume. The reason that silver stopped being coined is because there was such a scarcity of silver that most silver miners could find higher prices in private commercial markets than selling it back to the government. Very little silver was being sold to the government to turn into coins. Thus, by the early 1870s, we were moving somewhat in the direction of only coining gold coins anyway, just out of necessity. Other world governments, Britain and France especially, had moved to solidly a gold standard only. And so there was this belief among many of the world's leading financiers that if the whole world worked on one standard, a gold standard, that would make money stable throughout the world. So there was this movement to stop coining silver, conveniently at the same time that people are not selling silver to the government. So in 1873, Congress passes an act banning the coining of silver, stopping it, almost acknowledging what was already happening anyway, rather than making any great change. But two other things occur following this demonetization of silver, two things that will cause people to call it the crime of 73. One is the discovery of new silver mines out west, or new silver discoveries in the mines, which drive the value of silver down so low that you can get more selling it to the government at 16-1 than you could in the private market. So silver miners now who want to sell this to the government find they can't, and they're wanting to know why. And of course, the explanation that seems easiest is conspiracy by bankers to make gold worth more. And then the other event that occurs which creates concern is the panic of 1873, one of those 20-year cyclical panics we've mentioned. So as unemployment raged and people are out of a job. There is this natural desire to say, let's inflate the currency so we can create jobs. Why can't we do so? In fact, we're going backwards. Money is contracting and shrinking. You're not even coining silver. Why? Banker conspiracy, always the quick immediate answer. So that's what brought about the so-called naming it of the crime of 73. We'll have to do them both in order. Let's see. The first reason would be that they've discovered more silver veins, and the second one was I'm lost. Somebody help me out. What? Conspiracy of the bankers to try to drive it out of way so the gold would be more valuable. And the panic of 1873 accentuated everybody's position on where this is at. Bankers wanting to protect their holdings, debtors wanting to inflate the currency supply. So there's political rumblings in Western states, for sure, to re-coin silver. And that goes from 1873, 4, 5, 6, 5. Finally, in 1878, in item 47 of 1878, Congress does pass a bill to purchase silver called the Bland-Allison Act, named for Richard Bland and William Allison. And I say this with a straight face, Richard Bland's nickname was Silver Dick. And this law called for the purchase and coinage of $2 million to $4 million worth of silver a month. So that's back to monetization, not as much as inflationists would like, but yes. William Allison. The Bland-Allison Act. It's in item 47. So it calls for $2 to $4 million worth of silver to be purchased and coined each month. Then it looks like 12 years later, another victory is achieved for inflationists in 1890 when John Sherman, the sponsor of our antitrust law, brother of William Tecumseh Sherman that burned Atlanta, shepherds through Congress the Sherman Silver Purchase Act, which calls for the coining, purchasing coining of 4 million ounces a month. And in looking at different textbooks to try to figure out how much is an ounce worth in regards to dollars, it just says that the purchasing coinage of 4 million ounces a month almost meant every bit of silver that was being coined. So by 1890, the inflationists are almost up to free and unlimited coinage like they wanted. Then we turn to the last page of our material before the exam, item 49. In all of this goings on, panic of 1893, 94, 95, and debate over the money standards, Cleveland has shown himself to be very uncomfortable with the silver movement. He's much more at home with stable banking practices and is a gold standard advocate, or gold bug as they call him. And gold bugs and silverites existed in both parties. This is one of those things where you could be kind of bipartisan in both directions. If you were a Western Republican, you probably were a silverite because you might be a farmer, you might be a silver miner, and you wanted inflationists. If you were an Eastern Republican, you might be the banker that wants the gold standard. And kind of similar for Democrats, urban business Democrats versus Southern and Western farming Democrats. So this is an issue that was more class-oriented than it was party-partisan-oriented. And it is also going to be considered the beginning of the first class struggle election in 1896 over these issues. So we come back to our issue about silver. And as we know, as I left it in item 48, the purchase of almost all the silver that could be found was going on and turned into coins in 1890 through the Sherman Act. But the panic of 1893 will change things, and here's why. With all the silver now that's to be purchased in coin, lots of gold is leaving the treasury. There's the trading in of the silver for the gold. And when the gold reaches the point, conveniently during the panic of 1893, that it's going to dip below $100 million worth of gold in the treasury, that's when business people and bankers go to Cleveland and say, if we start to lose all our gold to this cheap silver, we'll run the risk of having no security for our economy. That's why this panic is taking place, because of all the silver exchange. If you go to Congress and urge the repeal of the Sherman Silver Purchase Act, get back on a solid gold standard, we will do our best to invest in the markets to get us out of this panic. And Cleveland, who is already sympathetic to the position, does so. It goes to Congress, urges the repeal of the Sherman Act. Bankers, business investors live up to their promise. And by 1894, 95, 96, things are starting to improve. And why? In the eyes of the populists and the inflationists and the debtors, because this shows us that a few rich capitalist bankers run the economy. They can destroy the economy, they can cause a panic, and they can rescue a country. That shows us how elitist our government and our business system is. Was there ever another greater time to indicate the need for the nine planks of the Populist Party platform? So that's not what that's not an accurate portrayal of what all the economic conditions, but it's what the populists and the poor farmers felt. And not just populists, it's also what poor Republican and poor Democratic farmers felt too. So there is this collision of the panic of 1893 with the silver and gold issue. Thus, by the 94, 95, 96 elections, 94 midterm elections and 96 presidential elections, we're back to no coinage of silver. That's why that first plank is in there, the free and unlimited coinage of silver at a ratio of 16 to 1, because of this fight over trying to inflate the money with paper money and then with silver. Again, it's not the only issue that populists wanted, but it becomes the overarching issue in the 1896 election. And so that's where we are now, is at item 53, the 1896 election. Called the Battle of the Standards, meaning the Battle of Monetary Standards. Republicans will end up being the pro-gold party. Democrats will be the bi-metallic party, or the gold and silver party. Yeah, Republicans will become the party that embraces the gold standard, and the Democratic Party will become the bimetallic or gold and silver party. I said earlier that the parties had silverites and gold bugs in both. So this is a realignment. What's going to happen is, at least temporarily for this election, traditional Democrats and Republicans will do some side switching to get on which way of the money issue they want to go. Why does it become such? It becomes such because of one Democratic candidate, William Jennings Bryan, who appears in item 54. William Jennings Bryan was born in Nebraska, became a lawyer and a labor advocate in Illinois. Although a staunch member of the Democratic Party, he was always very sympathetic to and embraced many of the principles of the populist movement. And he was known as the Great Commoner, because he seemed to champion the concerns of the little guy all the time. Also called the Boy Orator of the Platte, meaning Platte River, Nebraska. He was one of the most powerful speakers of his day. It is said that he could address an auditorium full of 100,000 people. I don't know how any auditoriums held 100,000 people in that time period, but could do so without a microphone and be heard at the back. So this is how much of a powerful speaker he was. If you've ever seen the movie Inherit the Wind, made in 1960, that's William Jennings Bryan. Well, that's not really him, but the actor's portraying William Jennings Bryan at the end of his life in 1925 in the Scopes Monkey Trial. So Bryan's famous for having run for president three times, 1896, losing to McKinley, 1900, losing to McKinley, 1908, losing to Taft. That's what Bryan's first famous for. Then serving as secretary, these are all just extra things not on the test here, serving as Secretary of State for Wilson and getting into a big fight with him over German submarines and quitting. And then in the 20s, finishing his life as a fundamentalist minister, fighting against Darwinian evolution and dying at the Scopes trial. So he's quite a figure here. He actually died 5 days after the trial, but the movie makes it look like he dies at the very end of the last day of the trial. But it was 5 days after the trial was over. But he threw his life into it so much that that's really what he burned up every ounce of energy he had left fighting for his cause. He is Matthew Harrison Brady in the movie. Not to be confused with Matthew Brady, the Civil War photographer. Some of those names could be confusing. He's an interesting character. And his father was a Baptist minister. He himself was a lay deacon Presbyterian minister. So he always associated religion with politics, that one crusade is the same as the other, fighting for the common person. That's why he always identified as a member of the Democratic Party. He wanted to make sure that he was nominated at the convention in Chicago in 1896 by his good friend John Peter Altgeld, governor of Illinois. You may recall Altgeld as the one that probably should have been contacted by the Railway Managers Association during the Pullman strike, but was passed over because the railroad owners knew he was pro-labor and was pro-strike. So what's happening here is a liberal, radical, common, working class element is taking control of the Democratic Party. And when he gets the nomination and gives his Cross of Gold speech, in which he slams the bankers and slams the tight money policy people as being like money changers in the temple, and that he throws his arms out like somebody on a cross and says, "You shall not press down upon labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." I mean, all the silverites just, you know, tears flowing in this situation. And the gold bugs out the door walking. They're leaving, heading for St. Louis for the Republican convention. Before we get to the Republicans in item 59, let's talk a little bit about our populace here. They watch these things take place, the Democratic convention, and eventually the Republican convention, also held in St. Louis where the populace will hold theirs, and they debate among themselves. They say, where do we stand on Bryan seemingly embracing so much of our principles? In fact, one thing I didn't mention was, if you go back to 41, planks 1 through 4 and 9, the silver, the direct election of senators, graduated income tax, political reforms, 1 through 4, and 9, the opposition to court injunctions, they made up the Democratic Party platform in 96 with the addition of low tariffs. So if you take 1 through 4, number 9, and add low tariffs to it, you have the 1896 Democratic Party platform. So you're a populist. What do? Here? Do you go ahead and still run Nader as third party and let McKinley win the election? Or do you capitulate on things like the Democratic Party? It's a laissez-faire party. They have not talked at all about the nationalization of railroads or banks. Do you give up those goals and go halfway? They do. It causes some members to leave, but the majority say, foot in the door with Bryan is the start, and down the road we can get more. So the populists in their convention decide they too will nominate William Jennings Bryan. So two different parties have nominated the same person here. Democrats nominate Bryan, populists nominate Bryan. Now the Democrats, in order to try to keep some kind of unity of the party, nominated for their Democratic candidate Arthur Sewell, a New York banker. So there's silverite with New York banker on the ticket and the Democrats. Something the populists couldn't stomach. So rather than nominate Sewell, also they nominate Thomas Watson, Georgia governor, populist. Well, doesn't matter though, because it's going to be Sewell that wins, but then populists don't have to have their hands soiled by supporting a banker. They're hoping by putting the populist element with the Democratic element, they'll overwhelm Republicans. Well, Republicans meet in St. Louis. The party is being steered by campaign manager Marcus Alonzo Hanna. Hanna's the kingmaker, he's called at that time, because he was the one that was able to get so many Republican presidents elected off crafty campaigning. McKinley is the candidate chosen, Ohio senator, sponsor of the McKinley tariff. And Hanna says the way to do this is let McKinley stay home and sit on the front porch, don't travel about, look stately, look presidential, have important people come to visit, get that photograph put in the newspapers, and it'll look like here is someone who is settled and stable and knows what he's doing, and here's this crazy Bryan running around the country screaming for silver. And it's exactly what Bryan did. Bryan got on trains and traveled 18,000 miles in the hustings of the campaign of 1896, which was looked by many people to be, that's too ambitious. You're not supposed to want the office that bad. You're supposed to be willing to serve, but not so ambitiously greedy that you go out and beg the vote. Of course, that's exactly a 20th century way of campaigning now. If you don't go out and beg the vote, you don't get any. So Bryan pioneered an early form of what became 20th century politics, and McKinley instead stayed at home on the advice of Hanna. And as they watched Bryan campaign, all the other planks of the Democratic Party platform just disappear, and Bryan talks silver. In fact, he talks silver like religion. Everybody's soul can be saved by inflation, inflating the economy with silver. So Hanna decides the best way to attack this is just talk the reverse and say this guy's crazy, he's going to destroy the economy through inflation. We need someone that understands a good, stable economy based on gold. So that's why it's called the Battle of the Standards, because it really does become whether or not you want to inflate the money supply or maintain gold, which was not the issues that everybody was concerned with. And it's at this point here in item 60 where we want to bring up those historians who have guessed and assumed that the Wizard of Oz story written by L. Frank Baum is not just a children's story but an allegory of the populist movement. Now, in one of the collection of readings that I think we have on the reserve shelf in the library called Historical Vistas by John A. Garrity, there's an article in it, he's the editor, there's an article in it called by Ray Allen Billington about, I don't forget the name of it, but it's making all the parallels to what went on in The Wizard of Oz that could be traced back to real history. And his argument is that the three people heading down the yellow brick road with Dorothy, all are symbolic. First, Dorothy's from what state? Yeah, so that's where, you know, the populist movement gets to start from. And the scarecrow represents farmers who are seemingly without a brain but actually have quite a little, you know, a bit of craftiness to them. Then there is the Tin Man, who in the story is interpreted as to be the working class factory worker who's been so automated that he loses his heart and his soul. And the Lion is William Jennings Bryan himself, who scratched at the Tin Man, the working class, never could get those votes over as he wanted. The Wizard is Grover Cleveland, the phony baloney wizard who will do nothing to help out people when Coxey's army makes it to Washington or makes it to the Emerald City. And, you know, in the movie it's ruby red slippers, but in the book it's silver slippers. So with silver slippers on the yellow brick road, gold and silver, you can make your way to Washington. So there's kind of parallels. And the Wicked Witch of the... Well, the witches. In the story, the witches in North and South are good, right? Those are farmer alliances, North, Northwest and Southern. And the Wicked Witches of East and West, the East is the bankers. What happens to bankers? House mortgages finally fall on them. And then the Witch of the West was just the barrenness of the climate that was only solved by rain or water, quenching things. What else is the Native Americans are considered the monkeys who have to work as servants for the witch. There's a lot of other parallels. I forgot. I don't know what Toto is. People always ask, what's Toto?
Okay,
oh, gosh. What was it? I forgot the name. It's in Historical Vistas, edited by John A. Garrity, and the author of the article is Ray Allen Billington. Can't hear it?
I can't hear
it. Okay, again. Ray Allen Billington is the author. It's in a collection of writings called Historical Vistas, edited by John A. Garrity. And I know years ago I saw it on our library shelf in here. So if it's not there, you can get it on Amazon real cheap. It's a good story. John A. Garrity. Now, Baum himself, the author of The Wizard of Oz, never said that's what the story was about. In fact, when asked, did OZ mean ounces, 16 ounces to one? He always denied that and said that he got the idea when he was looking at a file cabinet that said O to Z on it, and that's where he got the name of the story. But he was himself very enthusiastic in the populist movement and concerned about farmers' causes, so it may have been, he stuck that in there. Well, back to our election here in item 61. You would think that if traditional Western farmers who vote Republican follow their populist instincts and vote Democratic for Bryan, that he's got all the Western states. In fact, you should have all the states with farmers in it. That would mean the old Northwest, too, would vote Democratic. And you have all the South automatically because they vote Democratic all the way until the 1960s. And if you get the working class people, which the populists are trying to draw into this movement, we always mention how poorly they did that, but if you get the working class people to vote their pocketbook, workers back east, farmers everywhere, people down south, it should be a gigantic victory for Bryan. But it's not. It turns out not only to be a victory for McKinley, it is a realigning election, which gives Republicans control of White House and Congress till 1932. Why? 62 asks. Why is it such a defeat? Well, here are some of the explanations given. Bryan, when he spoke, really evoked the image of the old-fashioned Protestant charismatic minister. It emphasized and drove home the waspy nature of the West, not the multicultural European immigrant cultures of the eastern cities. So a lot of Catholic voters, they say, just couldn't stomach the waspiness of Bryan's preachy style. So culturally, they turned off people, especially Irish. Also, as far as getting workers into the party, workers just didn't vote in the numbers that were anticipated. Some of it was they just weren't convinced that inflating the currency with silver was going to help their wages. They saw this as almost harebrained, and it didn't take much for Hannah to continue to drive that home, that if you vote for Bryan, you'll be unemployed later. Vote for McKinley, you'll have a better economy. So that convinced a lot. But those who were drawn into the class-mindedness of this and wanted to vote for Bryan, it is said, were told which color ballots to vote for if you still want a job when you come back. So even if they'd wanted to vote for Bryan, there was great pressure without a secret ballot for them to be able to. So it's hard to judge just where the hearts of the working class were, but the votes weren't with Bryan, they were with McKinley. And then to make things also bad for Bryan, in the summer going into the fall of the 1896 election, crop prices rose. Kind of the reverse happened to George Bush the Elder, and that's how Clinton got elected. The economy took a dip just long enough for Bush to lose to Clinton. And therefore, a lot of farmers did not identify as farmers. I mean, the people in the Ohio and Illinois and Indiana who'd paid off their debts and were not in any Dutch with the banks, they wanted to stay traditionally Republican, unlike the people out west. And there was a lot more of those farmers in the old Northwest than there was in the far west. So that's why the vote turned as it did. And as your textbook says, the electoral count was 271 for McKinley to 176 for Bryan. The popular vote, 7.1 million votes for McKinley to 6.5 million votes for Bryan. A defeat for Bryan, one of the three that he will face. A defeat for the populists. They would try 4 years later in 1900 to run a candidate, but get little votes, finally disappear, but reincarnate as progressives, as we'll mention later. In the years following the 1896 election, in 1897 and 1898, numerous gold discoveries are made in Alaska in the Klondike area and in Australia. And the influx of new gold into the currency inflated things and helped farm prices rise, letting both sides to say, see, we were right. Democrats, Republicans saying it's gold that we needed all along, and Democrats and populists saying it's more currency we needed all along. But the Republicans won the election. And in the McKinley administration, along with the Spanish-American War, which we'll discuss in our next section, they passed the Dingley Tariff of 1897, the highest tariff up to that point. And in Congress, they passed the Gold Standard Act, which dropped the coining of silver coins until the Progressive Era. So now you need the numbers, certainly. Yes, the Dingley Tariff was the highest tariff passed, and the Gold Standard Act was an official, again, demonetization of silver, which practically had already happened in the repeal of the Sherman Act, but now it was made law that they wouldn't coin silver coins. And they'll pick that up again in the 1910s. But it's a sound victory for the Republicans, though, not for the Democrats. But you know, you can also see this. Some of the class struggle notions, some of the rhetoric that's used, some of the campaign tactics will come back in the 1930s and stay permanent in elections. Okay, page one starts off with race relations of the South, number one, Reconstruction. That's the first page. I'll go through here and tell you which numbers to circle and maybe which words to underline if that's all you need to worry about. Number two, number six, seven, eight. Actually, 6 through 15 are all there. There's a question on 6 through 15.
Did you say number 1?
No, I did not. On the page that starts off with race relations in the South underlined. The very so number 2 and then 6 through 15. It might help if I let you know what part of 15 is there. It's the Plessy case, 14th Amendment, and how the 1883 Civil Rights case dealt with the 1875 Civil Rights Act. That's the part that's being looked at here. On the second page, 17, specifically why the Senate was nicknamed the Millionaires Club. 20, 23, 24, 25, 26, 28. Okay. 17, 20, 23 through 26, and 28. Next page, A through E on 30. 33, 34. 37, there's kind of numerous things in 37. 38, and I think the main thing out of 38 I want you to know is what is anarchism or anarcho-syndicalism. Yes. In item 30, A through E, 33, 34, 37, and in 38, mainly knowing what anarchism is or anarcho-syndicalism is. Then on the short page, it has numbers 41 through 47. The ones you need to know are 41, 44, 45, 46. And look at this page, how much I've drawn all over this thing. So there must be some good questions on that. Now the politics page, where the numbers start over with 1 again. On that page, numbers 6 through 9 and 11 and 12. On the next page, 25, 26, 32, 34. On the next page, 50, 59. Did I skip a page? Oh, okay, yeah. Okay, I apologize, yeah. Starting with 36, where it says crop prices fluctuate. Okay, here are the numbers on the page you need to know. 37, 38, 41, and 44. Something of 41. I'm not going to say which. That way you have to count. Well, it could be one of these all the following are except type things. So. And on the last page, 50, 59, and although not on the test, believe it is, so you'll look at it again, number 54, because it's so cool. It's not on the test, but it's good stuff. And 62. Yes, that's the way to say it. So you've been given a chance to know that everything's on the test. Most of the questions are who shot John rather than why was John shot. And I think I brought a sample test. If you want to, you can run away if you want, or I'll read a couple of questions of what you're going to take. Okay. Give you a flavor for it. Scantron.